we have on the docket for today is Perry Edward Jones versus Laurie Gates Jones. And Mr. Walsh, do you want to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to ask to reserve 5 minutes.
All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Your Honor.
And I'm Judge Adley, in case you've never seen me before, Mr. Walsh.
Judge, if I see you again.
Maybe not have seen him in this position before.
No, I haven't, but I did see you when you came down to the investiture ceremony a couple weeks ago for Judge Rizek. It's nice seeing you again. May it please the court, my name is John Walsh, and I represent the appellant, Perry Jones. On December 22, 2013, the parties entered into a property settlement agreement. This is a result of nearly 11 months of litigation and negotiations, during which time both parties were represented by counsel. For the appellee, her present counsel, and for the appellant, his former counsel. The parties took special care when they entered into their agreement to make it clear that their agreement represented the entirety of their understanding and included as their third paragraph, and I quote, entire agreement. Husband and wife acknowledge that this agreement contains the entire understanding between husband and wife, and there are no representations, warranties, covenants, or undertakings other than those expressly set forth herein. The parties then set out to address the division of the appellant's military retirement. And in paragraph 21 of their agreement, they provided that the wife shall receive one half of the marital share of husband's military retirement accounts and plans. Such division shall be done by a quadro, adro, or other required mechanism. The costs of preparing the paperwork shall be at wife's expense. The marital share shall be a fraction, the numerator of which is the number of reserve retirement points earned during the marriage, and the denominator is the husband's total number of reserve retirement points. If husband has a further retirement component based on credible months of service, the wife will also receive a similar one-half marital share of that benefit, with the numerator and denominator expressed in months of credible service rather than reserve retirement points. Husband shall elect or cause to be selected participation in the Survivor Benefit Plan, SBP, of at least 50% of the survivor benefit. No other provisions were made regarding the division of the retirement in their agreement. That agreement was incorporated into their final decree. And subsequent to the entry of the final decree, the appellant, lack of any provisions in the agreement which indicated the parties agreed to such, requested the trial court, and the trial court did, over the objections of Kirchner Pilley.
Do all agreements in Virginia come with an implied covenant of fair dealing and good faith?
I don't believe there is, Judge, but even if there is an implied covenant of good faith, the retirement order that was submitted by Appellee went much further than that. It put in very specific requirements, restrictions, duties on the part of the husband, none of which were bargained for or agreed to. And when you refer back to the fact that in paragraph 3, they were very clear to say that there was nothing that they were going to imply, that the agreement would be only what was expressly set forth therein. I would acknowledge that under some circumstances, there may be more to the story. And I'll give an example.
Well, I take your position as even if there is an implied covenant of good faith, it doesn't necessarily result in paragraphs 15, 16, and 17.
Correct, Judge, which go a lot further than anything, very specific duties. As an example I would give, I would concede that there may be a point if DFAS were to pay to Mr. Jones money that under the agreement should have gone to Mrs. Jones, perhaps Ms. Jones under 20-103K would have the ability to come back to court, in which case the court would look at the actual words that were contained in their agreement to determine what Mr. Jones's duties and obligations are. However, the order that was entered by the Henrico Circuit Court put in a lot of very specific requirements, which, if there ever is a further litigation between the parties, will become the basis for establishing what Mr. Jones's duties and obligations are, duties and obligations not contained in their agreement. I would note some of the more, I think, significant provisions in the order that were objected to. The order provides that appellant is required to maintain an SBP benefit at a level sufficient to ensure that the appellee receives the same benefit that she would have received during the appellant's lifetime after his death. The actual wording of the parties' separation agreement says that the SPP will be maintained at a level of 50%. I mean, that's just a complete deviation from what was set forth in the parties' agreement. It prohibits appellant from merging his retired pay with any other pension, although this possibility was clearly envisioned and provided for in the agreement. And I would submit that here you have a situation where Mr. Jones, at the time the agreement was entered into, was already working for the federal government, and the parties specifically put into their agreement that if he would receive a retirement component, which is measured based on longevity, that there was a mechanism for dealing with that, in which case the formula would be converted from one dealing with points to one dealing with months. It broadly prohibits appellant from taking any course of action which would defeat wife's right to receive a portion of the disposable military pay. Again, I believe that Mr. Jones's duties and obligations should stand solely on what was set forth in the agreement, and I think that with this order, it certainly opens Mr. Jones up to the possibility that he could be held in contempt of court for taking actions that might not have been prevented by the agreement.
Can I ask you, counsel, about the apparent, I mean, the argument by Appley that DFAS, if I'm pronouncing that acronym
yes.
correctly, recommended essentially some of these additions because in order to effectuate a protection of the spouse's survivorship benefits, that if they weren't made, the argument seemed to be, then we can't guarantee that would occur. How do you respond to that argument about DFAS encouraged this?
I think that's a misunderstanding. DFAS actually has a model order, and it has a guide to dividing military retirements. And there were two orders that were submitted to the court that the court can consider. There was the one that was proffered by the appellee, and there was the one that was proffered by us. And I would submit that the order that was proffered by us, almost word for word, was exactly what's in the DFAS model order. None of the objected to provisions that we're making an issue out of, none of them were contained in the model order of DFAS or in the DFAS guide on dividing military retirements. What appellee did instead was she relied on a fact that there is a book by Mark Sullivan where he recommended that these provisions be included in order to prevent service members from being able to take advantage, in his words, of the non-service member spouse. But even in Mark Sullivan's book, I would submit that he says that the time to do that is at the time of contract, because once the contract's signed, it may be too late to get that language in. One of my assignments of error is I do believe that the court should have entered the order that we submitted. And as to the order that we submitted, I would note that there were only two things that appellee's expert made an issue out of. One was she said that we didn't have the zip codes in the addresses. Well, I would submit that, one, I don't think it was clear that the DFAS guide required the zip codes, but that would be a very easy fix if that were the case. I would look at that as purely a ministerial issue. The second was, with regard to my reference to the survivor benefit plan, I refer to the Reserve Component Survivor Benefit Plan, RCSBP, as opposed to the Survivor Benefit Plan, because that was the applicable benefit plan here. Ms. Shaner, when she testified, she said that that DFAS would know that it was a reserve component, and that's just not normally done that way. But certainly there was no indication that it would affect.
If I understand your argument, in toto, we shouldn't consider anything Ms. Shaner said anyway, right? And neither should the trial court?
Yes, Judge. I do have an issue with the fact that Ms. Shaner was allowed to testify. She prepared the order that was being presented to the court, and then basically she was allowed to get on the witness stand and say all the reasons why her order was more legitimate, I guess, than our order.
On page 18 of your brief, I think you address her testifying the issue, but I don't see a citation to a rule, a case, or a statute. So have you in your brief cited to any of the authority that would support disqualifying her?
And I would submit that I haven't found any, and I'm just submitting it to the court. It honestly doesn't even matter whether or not Ms. Shaner testified or not, in my opinion, for what the ultimate outcome should be regarding the order. I do believe that it would be helpful for the court to give some guidance to whether attorneys can get on the witness stand and testify in support of documents that they drafted or assisted in drafting in. But I would simply submit that issue to the court because I don't really think it makes a big difference one way or the other what happens with the ultimate outcome of the case. A couple of other provisions mentioned in the brief. The order requires Mr. Jones to submit to Ms. Jones any monies that she should have received if she doesn't receive it within 14 days. That requirement is put in there, one, without any requirement that Mr. Jones actually receive the money. It, in fact, makes him a guarantor of the United States government. If there's a sequestration that affects military retirements or any kind of administrative error or what have you, regardless of whether or not Mr. Jones receives the monies, he's under a court order obligation to send it to Ms. Jones. Second thing is the judge, in his ruling,
continues, if you wish to, I just want to remind you, you are entering into your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The judge in his ruling specifically noted that the proper language by the appellee, which would require a five-day payment, was found nowhere. There was no support of that, and yet the court then adopted, without any support, a 14-day requirement. I'll reserve the remainder of my time, judges.
Ms. Paas?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Brandy Paas. I represent Ms. Jones. When the parties signed their agreement, they acknowledged in the agreement that they were going to need a military qualifying court order. Their agreement says that wife is to receive 50% of the marital share, and that's to be effectuated by an MCQO. So they knew at the time that they weren't just going to take the language in their agreement, submit it to DFAS, and divide up the retirement. They knew that there was going to have to be other language incorporated in some other document in order to effectuate that. Otherwise, they would just send off the agreement to the court. I mean, to DFAS. There was also a provision in their agreement stating that the parties agreed to sign any other documents necessary to give full force and effect to their agreement. Yes, sir?
That's paragraph 6.
That I'm not sure. I'll go with that. That sounds like that may be correct.
And the last sentence of that says, provided that no financial obligations are incurred thereby. Under paragraph 16 of the military qualifying order, if there is a shutdown of the federal government and he doesn't receive his retirement pay, does he have an obligation to pay her?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
And the reason that is because that paragraph of the order says that if she's not paid pursuant to the military qualifying court order, then he has to pay her. If you look at paragraph 4 of the military qualifying court order, which is on page 117 of the record, it states that the former spouse is entitled to direct payment in the amount specified below and shall receive payments as the same time as the member. So she's only receiving payments pursuant to this order if he's also receiving payments pursuant to the order. So if for some reason the government shuts down and he's not getting his money, she's not due any money pursuant to the order because she only gets the funds if he's receiving them. And that's paragraph 4 of page 117. So there would be no financial circumstances or financial undertakings that are in the military qualifying court order that are not also in the party's agreement. What is implied in order to effectuate agreement is as much in the agreement as what is expressly stated. The court looks at Boedeker v. Larson, which is cited in our brief. In that case, this is a Virginia case. In that case, the parties executed an agreement stating that wife would receive a portion of husband's pension from the Navy. Later, after the agreement, husband received a bonus that reduced what he actually received in his military retirement. The court said that even though there was nothing in the agreement about such a bonus, husband still had to pay her portion of that bonus because what she contracted for in the agreement was reduced by the bonus. This court stated that the agreement gave no indication that husband would be permitted under the terms of the agreement to reduce the amount of the retirement benefit.
But doesn't that suggest that paragraphs 15, 16, and 17, therefore, aren't necessary? Because don't they need to be necessarily implied? You can see they weren't expressly agreed to. So are they necessarily implied by the agreement, or can you get to the same place without them?
Can see that they were not actually the military qualifying court order was not actually incorporated into the agreement. So yes, you're correct that they were not actually stated, set forth in the agreement, but they're still part of the agreement because he actually has to pay her. If you contract to receive 50% of a military pension, it's implied that you actually have to get it, that he actually has to pay you, and he can't go defeat it in some reason. So I think your question is, would it be necessary?
Well, right. All the specific terms in paragraphs 15, 16, and 17 of the military qualifying order actually necessary to protect her interest?
Yes, because...
Actually necessary as opposed to convenient, as opposed to it would make it more efficient, as opposed to it doesn't leave her in the lurch.
It would be necessary in this case because it appears that husband thinks it's okay for him to merge his military pension because he's bringing a case to the Court of Appeals and because he wants to take out of an order a provision that says he can't defeat his wife's contracted for provision.
Well, right, but if Boddicker is correct, and of course it's binding on us, you don't need this language to get relief and prevent him from doing that or at least paying you the cash equivalent, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but then she has to proceed with file more cases in the future, incur more attorney's fees in order to do something that could have been done at the beginning. And also the...
Could have been done, but the question is, was it?
And was done, Your Honor, by the trial court. That could have been done at the time you do the military qualifying court order, and that's what the court did. So the question is not, did the court have to do it? The question is, did the court err by doing it?
Well, and would you have at least concede it would have been a better idea to address this before the agreement was reached? Before the agreement is finalized, saying this is what the military order will look like.
I don't think they had to, but in the event they would have discussed it then instead of now, I don't think it was necessary.
So they didn't have it. If he says these terms I didn't agree to, they didn't have a full agreement when they signed the document because they're still fighting over this, right?
Not necessarily. He could have agreed to something and then not now want to do it. I don't know why he would have agreed to that and then now not want to do it, but that's what their agreement is. Take it as when you contract to pay someone pursuant to 2109, the court cannot enter an order that allows you to not actually have to pay them. So, and that's basically what Boddicker says. But it's also the same with spousal support. You have a contractual right, if the court awards you spousal support, to go back and ask that it be changed pursuant to material change in circumstances. However, if you have a property settlement agreement that says that you're to receive a certain amount of spousal support and it doesn't mention modifiability, then it's not modifiable. It's the same analogy that we have here, is that if you contract to receive 50% of the pension, it's not modifiable unless you say it is. And so it's not... The appellant argues that we would have had to put in the agreement that he's not allowed to defeat her interest, when actually it's the exact opposite. The agreement would have had to have stated that he is allowed to modify what he agreed to. It's the same with spousal support, and it's the same with attorney's fees under the Rutledge case.
Well, with spousal support, doesn't your property interest vest with each month of spousal support as it comes due?
That's true as far as when the arrearage is created.
Okay. Wouldn't it also be true that her property interest in any individual pension payment comes when it becomes paid and due?
No, sir. Her property interest in the pension actually vests at the time of the signing of the property settlement agreement, and that is, it's at the beginning of our brief, but there's a case that addresses when your interest in a pension pursuant to a property settlement agreement vests, and it's not when you receive each payment. It's when you actually contract to receive it or when the final decree is entered, and that's the Irwin case. And it's on page 8 of our brief.
Where was the, in paragraph 16, where was the 14-day time period implied from the parties' discussions?
Just the actual date, the actual time frame of when he has to pay her is not in there, but it's implied that if he's receiving her money, he needs to pay it to her. If he wanted to do a date other than 14 days, that would have been fine. It's just a ministerial execution of the party's agreement. They had to pick some time in order for him to be paid. I don't think that the appellant has an issue with the amount of days. I think my understanding from his argument on brief and at trial is that his issue is with the fact that he's ordered to pay her at all if she's not paid. But I think the misunderstanding is that that doesn't happen unless he's getting the money pursuant to the agreement. So for some reason, the government shuts down. It's not like he's going to have to pay her something that he's not also receiving himself. There are a number of cases from other states. Virginia has not yet addressed these. I couldn't find a case where the question was, can these provisions or should these provisions be put into a military qualifying court order if they're not specifically set out in the agreement? And there's case after case from other states that are go through in our brief that I'm sure you don't want me to go through and recite again, but where the court finds yes. I don't think I found any where the court said no, that they shouldn't be in there or that it's improper for it to be there. There are a number of cases where the party's agreement is silent as to the indemnification provisions, and the court finds that they should be in the military qualifying court order. There are cases where the court awards the percentage of the pension, and then when it comes time to draft the order, the court says those indemnification provisions should be in there. And then there are cases where it's not in the agreement or the order, and you're back later on a show cause motion, and the court finds that those indemnification provisions apply. Because you don't have to say in agreement that you agree to receive 50% of the pension, and by the way, you actually really have to pay it. I mean, that's implied in the agreement. And because of the different ways that military retirement can be waived for other benefits, that's why it's necessary to put those provisions in the order so that you're not dealing with it years later coming back on a show cause. And my understanding also from the appellant's brief is that he states that if she has an issue with it, you know, she could show cause him later. Well, if she can show cause him later and it's a violation of the order later, then it's not amending their agreement to go ahead and put it in the order now. I don't understand how it can be changing their agreement to put it in the order now if the appellant is saying he could be held in contempt later if he merges his benefits with some other form of retirement such that her payments are reduced. The appellants also mentioned the survivor benefit plan today, and the language was changed from what's in the agreement, but that was only to meet the requirements of DFAS. It still states the same thing. The party said in their agreement that she gets a 50% survivor benefit. The order reads that she's to receive the same amount that she was to receive while she was receiving payments, which is 50%, because that's what the party's contracted for. So it's 50% either way. It's just worded a different way in order to meet the requirements of DFAS. Judge, and there was a question about whether there's a requirement of fair dealing in contracts. And I can't answer that specific question. I know that there are several cases that deal with a court should not interpret a contract in a way that would reach an unreasonable result. It would be unreasonable to reach a result where the parties contracted for the wife to receive 50% of the pension, but only if husband decides to pay her and doesn't decide to merge it with some other form of benefit. Contracts are also not to be construed in a way that puts one party at the complete mercy of the other. And that's exactly what would happen if wife only receives her contracted for portion of the pension if husband decides not to waive it in order to receive some other benefit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Just pause.
Yes.
On assignment of error 4, can you talk to me a little bit about hearing from Ms. Shaner and the appearance of that, given that she helped draft some of the things that the judge was looking at? And I mean, she's certainly not someone who's an impartial expert witness, is she?
Judge, we were in court, I think it was in June, in order our first hearing to present the military qualifying court order. And we were disagreeing over what should be in the order. And the court told us, and it was in the transcript, go get experts, come back to tell me what should be in the order. So that's what we did. We went out, we hired an expert to come back and tell the court what should be in the order. And I don't know of a better way to do that other than how is she going to tell the court what's going to be in the order without giving us the provisions for an order? And the appellant didn't object at that, I can't remember whether it was June or July, at that first hearing where the court said, go out and get an expert, tell me what's going to be in the order. He didn't object to that.
Well, how did he know it would be somebody who was from your firm and had worked on the file?
She hadn't worked on the file, Your Honor. She was, I think she and Mr. DeFazio drafted the agreement. But Ms. Shaner was not at the same firm at the time that agreement was drafted. Mr. DeFazio had already left that firm. And I can't remember whether the record said Ms. Shaner had left already, but at the time the agreement was drafted, Ms. Shaner, they were not at the same firm. And there was no evidence that Ms. Shaner had ever worked on the file before being hired as an expert.
Saw about the agreement was when the court, through you as counsel, asked for experts, and then you hired her.
Correct. The court asked for an expert. We went out and hired an expert. That was the first she'd ever seen of the file or heard of Mrs. Jones.
My understanding of the record, and perhaps I misunderstood it, is that she gave testimony on the requirements of federal law. Is that correct?
She did. She gave testimony on the requirements of the DFAS for what should be in an order and whether what's in that order changes the agreement or...
As a general proposition, expert testimony on legal issues is not permitted, because the idea being that there's only one expert on the law in any given courtroom, and that's the person wearing the black robe. Are you aware of any authority that would permit a witness to testify as an expert on issues of what is required by federal law?
Yes. Well, I know there was at least, I tried to look up to see other cases from other states, because I couldn't find any in Virginia where there needed to be testimony about a retirement order. And there was one in California. It's in Remarriage of Smith, which is on page 36, where there was an expert in military retirement benefits that prepared the order and presented it to the court and testified about it, very, very similar to our case. It's not just about federal law. It's about what's required to be. It's military law, what's required to be in the order. And that's not something that a lot of judges, or even many circuit court judges, know exactly what that should be. And that's why he asked us to present that testimony. And there was no objection at the time from the appellant that an attorney was going to present that evidence. In fact, I even said at that hearing, Judge, I think that person would be an attorney. The court agreed, and there was no objection from the appellant. I think that I'm going to ignore the question. I didn't know if I was. Am I out of time, Your Honors?
You are, but I'm happy to have you complete your question.
Okay.
From the court.
The question at trial was whether there's some kind of ethical violation by Ms. Shaner preparing the quadro and also testifying. So the court had us call the ethics hotline. The ethics hotline said there was no question whatsoever. We submitted that to the court, and then we heard nothing else from the appellant about Ms. Shaner's testimony. He submitted a couple pages of objections after the ruling, but there was nothing about Ms. Shaner.
Thank you. Mr. Walsh, you have your rebuttal time. And since I gave her a little extra time, I'll give you a little extra if you need as well.
Perhaps the advantage of being last. A couple things. First of all, with regard to Ms. Shaner, again, we don't look at that as being dispositive to the ultimate outcome of the case. I would submit, though, that when we were in court in June, there were a couple disputes that were going on with the drafts of the order that were then being presented. One was the calculation of retirement points and how they should be calculated. And there was a lot of discussion about that at that June hearing, and there was some disagreement. I believe that would have been something that would have been appropriate for an expert to get involved in. That issue ended up getting resolved prior to us arguing the points in October.
In the trial court, prior to her testifying, did you object at any point on any ground other than the lawyer-witness rule?
I did, Judge. When we were in October, I objected to the idea of her testifying because I said it was the prerogative of the court to determine what the law was. The judge felt that he wasn't familiar with that area of the law and he wanted her to testify. While she was testifying, two things came out. One was that at the beginning of the case, maybe not at the time the agreement was drafted, and I really don't know where in the whole process of that 11 months the agreement was actually drafted, but in the beginning of the case, Mr. DeFazio was working at the same firm that Ms. Shaner was working in. That objection was made and overruled. Then as Ms. Shaner began to testify, she made multiple references to the order I drafted, the order this, the order that, and became apparent, and upon questioning, that the order that was being submitted at the October hearing by the appellee was one that Ms. Shaner at least had a hand in drafting. And that's something that I objected to. The court did give me an opportunity to present authority to that, And quite frankly, I could not find any authority. I think perhaps because it's such an obvious point, but I would submit that this might be the good opportunity to make that authority. With regard to a couple of the other points that appellee made, she says that 20-109 prohibits the court from entering any military qualification court order unless it contains those provisions. I would submit there's nothing in 20-109 that provides that. There's nothing in any of the case law of this court or the Virginia Supreme Court or even any circuit court that I could find which says that there is statutorily required language that has to go in there. It certainly is not language that DFAS requires. The appellee constantly says that the appellant apparently thinks that it's okay to defeat the wife's interest. I would submit there's been never any evidence that the appellant's trying to defeat the wife's interest. All the appellant is saying is if there comes a point in time where she doesn't feel like she's getting what she feels she was owed, let me be judged upon the words of the contract, not all these other requirements which have been added subsequent by the judge. I would submit that kind of rewriting is exactly the kind of adding additional provisions that Rutledge and Owens in those cases say the court cannot introduce just because they're provisions that are commonly used. And then the Bodecker case, I would submit Bodecker case is a perfect point. You know, the court was faced with a situation post-divorce which wasn't contemplated by the parties. The court looked at it and interpreted the parties' agreement, the language of the parties' agreement, to determine how that redux bonus should actually be applied. Does it count as military retirement? Does it not count as military retirement? And Bodecker, in that case, a result was given that enabled the wife to receive her share. If something comes up, Mr. Jones would be in that same situation. You know, wife would, I would assume, approach Mr. Jones and say, hey, I think you have my money and this is why. And Mr. Jones perhaps could agree and say, yeah, here's how I'm going to deal with it. Or perhaps they have disagreement and let a court determine it. But at that time, they should be looking at the wording of the contract, not all these multitude of other provisions that were added by the judge. If you are going to look at the cases of other states, I would note that a lot of those cases, if you actually read them, refer to case law and rules that come from their own state's laws that don't necessarily follow Virginia's, and or involve specific provisions that were in the contract, which they say led to the result that they were doing in that case. But if the court is going to look at cases from other states, I would ask the court to also look at Mallard versus Burkhardt, and that's a Supreme Court of Mississippi case, 2010 CA 02069. SCT. And I believe I'm out of time. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Any further questions for Mr. Walsh? All right. Thank you,
Mr. Walsh.
We will.